Our first talk is by T.J. Demos. It's entitled Poverty, Pornography, Humanitarianism, and Neoliberal Globalization on Renzo Martin's End Your Poverty, 2008. I'm just going to briefly introduce you T.J. Demos, who is a reader in the Art History Department at University College in London. He writes widely on modern and contemporary art and politics, and is the author most recently of Return to the Post-Colony, Spectres of Colonialism in Contemporary Art, 2013, and The Migrant Image, The Art and Politics of Documentary During Global Crisis, also 2013, Duke University Press. He also guest edited Third Text, 120, January 2013, which dedicated its issue on contemporary art and the politics of ecology. So without further ado, please help me to introduce and to welcome T.J. Demos.
Thanks very much, Christine, and thanks everyone for coming. Password? It's a great pleasure to be here, and as soon as we figure out this minor glitch, I'll
just get.
Oh, okay. Okay. So as Christine mentioned, this is. The book that recently came out from Sternberg Press and just a couple weeks ago. And the presentation that I'm going to give today is a small version, a shorter version of one of the chapters in this book that looks at different, mostly European artists, such as Sven Augustinen, Vincent Mason, Zarina Bimji, Renzo Martins, and also a South African photographer, Peter Hugo, who all in their diverse work, mostly film but also photography, are investigating conditions, post-colonial conditions in sub-Saharan Africa and the kind of hauntings that remain in relationship to contemporary experience both there and in the European context. So this is, because I had to condense this and I want to make sure I get everything in into the time limit, I'm going to read this. So I apologize in advance. It's not my favorite way of delivering a paper. I'd prefer just to speak. But without further ado, Renzo Martins' film, Enjoy Poverty, from 2008-09, set in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, provides a devastating optic on the brutal nature of North-South relations of inequality and the exploitative image economy that stubbornly mediates it, despite all its risks, such as perpetuating stereotypes of Africans as helpless victims, reducing Congolese people to neo-colonized servants and neophytes, and reproducing a pornography of poverty, and perhaps even because of them. Enjoy Poverty bears important lessons, among them a reality check for optimistic globalists and a lethal blow to the ambitions of concerned documentarians, especially those that seek to ameliorate suffering by representing abjection in developing countries for sympathetic observers. The scandal that is the film puts us squarely before the fault lines of globalization's many crises today, including the disastrous fallout from neoliberal structural adjustment policies implemented in Africa and the global South since the 1980s, the failures of humanitarian practice and its compromised ethical discourse, and the paradoxes of both politically engaged photojournalism and contemporary art. The 90-minute film, and I'm sorry that this wasn't able to be screened in advance of the talk, but the last I looked, it was available online, so on Vimeo, I believe the whole thing is online, or on YouTube there's clips, so please check it out. So the 90-minute film focuses on the economy of images that portrays the poverty and suffering rife in the DRC, centering on the European photojournalists operating there, which is operating there. In one scene, Martin's questions an Agence France-Presse photographer about his wages, and it's the guy on the far left that he questions in an interview scene. It turns out that he earns 50 euros per shot, plus insurance and travel expenses. This example communicates how famine and war photography flow into a global image economy running on poverty and violence as fuel. As it unleashes a vicious cycle of profit, objectification, and sympathy, this type of conflict photography perpetuates clichés of Africans as helpless victims mired in misery and reduces spectators to depoliticized charitable donors. It's, of course, an old story. Going back to the food shortages in Biafra, southern Nigeria, during the 1968 civil war there, when journalists first encountered first produced horrific images of starving children in Africa meant to encourage relief aid. The images were themselves reminiscent of the brutal documents of Holocaust camp survivors at the end of World War II. Soon after, in the 1970s, artists and writers like Alan Sekula and Martha Rosler, who will speak later today, articulated some of the most trenchant critiques of what Sekula termed the pornography of the direct representation of misery. Pornographic for presenting a spectacle of poverty while obscuring its social and political causes and hiding the image's own embeddedness in a system that commodifies the titillating objectification of others' misfortune. Invoking such precedents, Martin's film builds on their analyses, but takes an alternate path to recent developments in disaster imagery. By refusing to turn away from the horrible images of media spectacle in a new era of poverty pornography. Indeed, Enjoy Poverty portrays the extensive system of humanitarianism. So these are all stills from the film. It portrays the extensive system of humanitarianism, global aid institutions, and the image economy today, which has moved far beyond the modes of vampiric documentarism of the 1960s and 70s, though it simultaneously reinvigorates the metacritical questions around media economy that were opened up by Sekula and Rosler, the significance of which remains evident today. Images of starving Africans, hawked by mass media, NGOs, and humanitarian organizations, continue unabated. Yet charity and aid seem to be ever inadequate, and so the images return day after day, leading to a haunting that is more than a cliche in mainstream media discourse. Enjoy Poverty reveals a surprising parallel between concerned image making and the international humanitarian industry, both of which risk exacerbating conflicts more than mitigating the contexts they work to alleviate. This owes in large part to the fact that NGOs, like photojournalists, proclaim to serve emergency victims, limiting their identity precisely to victimhood, yet come to depend on them, and importantly on their sensationalized images, to generate the funding streams that guarantee their continued existence. In this regard, the DRC is only one flashpoint for many such zones of conflict. Think of Afghanistan, Iraq, Haiti, and Sudan in recent years. In all of these contexts, we encounter an increasingly common logic of intervention that joins military response and humanitarian aid against the backdrop of defunded public institutions and eroding national infrastructure. Here, ethical imperatives and political justifications intertwine, challenging ruling concepts of legitimacy and legality. This new ethical turn opens onto the wider quandaries of contemporary humanitarianism, including its lack of accountability, its self-perpetuating institutions that prioritize highly visible and mediatized conflicts over non-sensationalized areas of devastation, and its self-declared political neutrality that often inadvertently serves power rather than helping victims in need, which are exactly the problems that Enjoy Poverty encounters in the DRC. And in that sense, I'm drawing on a huge literature that is critical of humanitarianism and NGO practice recently, and it's quite easy to find, but I'm thinking of authors like Linda Pullman and Alex DeWall, A.L. Weitzman, and several others who are writing very critically about humanitarianism today. This humanitarian turn is significant in the context of these macroeconomic transformations since the 1980s that have brought about the condition of failed states in so many areas, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's where the state can't provide for welfare that you have the explosion of humanitarianism. So that's part of the larger process of neoliberal globalization that's taking place today. In one particularly remarkable scene where Martins poses a question to the representative of the World Bank in Kinshasa, the film reveals exactly this inequality-producing macroeconomic structure behind what Alex DeWall calls the disaster relief industry. So I'll play a short clip of this fascinating interaction between Renzo Martins and a representative of the World Bank.
Vous vous présentez d'abord.
Oui, je suis Renzo Martins, hollandais. Je fais un film ici au Congo. Dans le montant qui a été accordé annuellement, donc c'était 1,8 milliard de dollars, quelque chose comme ça, quelle partie ça représente dans le revenu total du Congo? Ah, ça c'est gentil, oui. Quelle est la partie... Ce 1,8 milliard de dollars, quelle est la partie dans le revenu total du Congo? Et si c'est un montant, un pourcentage élevé, j'aimerais bien savoir si alors la lutte contre la pauvreté, pour lesquelles 1,8 milliard de dollars sont, est alors une ressource naturelle très importante pour le Congo pour l'instant, peut-être le plus important.
D'abord, la pauvreté, c'est pas une ressource naturelle. La pauvreté, c'est un défi commun pour la communauté internationale. Il est vrai que l'aide au développement apporte à la RDC plus d'argent que le cuivre ou le coltan et le diamant, même ensemble. Mais c'est normal, parce que c'est comme ça que se développe une situation.
So that's exactly Renzo Martins' point. Going further than simply targeting the World Bank, however, Martins implicates a broad range of international actors, such as multinational corporations carrying out resource extraction in the DRC, global financial institutions encouraging free trade over social welfare, and self-promoting humanitarian and disaster relief organizations cleaning up the civil war damage, and the media industry that is shown to be sensationalizing the whole series of events. NGOs like United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and the European Commission for Humanitarian Aid all come under particular fire for their shameless self-promotion, as logos are shown placed on the clothing, plastic tent sheeting, and supplies they pass out in camps for internally displaced people. This is what you see in this image here. Particularly the bottom image that shows you handing out the supplies and simultaneously photographing that charitable gift. So it's a simultaneous image production to justify their activities. All are implicated as related players in this condition of neoliberalism, which turns out to be continuous with the colonial past in using the language of modernization and development, while in reality wages decrease, poverty grows, and average life expectancy shortens. And indeed, Martin's character, showing trekking around the jungle trailed by a retinue of black porters, cannot avoid conjuring the long history of the visual iconography of colonial exploration and plunder, bringing to mind diverse literary and cinematic precedents, such as Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and Werner Herzog's Aguirre, The Wrath of God. It's from 1972. Instead of a more equitable and inclusive new world order, then, the present state of things, as witnessed in Enjoy Poverty, resembles what the International Forum on Globalization calls global economic apartheid. According to their argument, counter to the sanguine picture of globalization boosters like the IMF and World Bank, worldwide environmental devastation has unfolded amidst endless brutal wars over precious resources, while a widespread and growing democratic deficit rules and multinational corporations disregard national sovereignty and economic accountability, riding roughshod over their seemingly useless mechanisms. In other words, for these critics, what's happening in the Congo may not be a failure at all, but rather an intended outcome, and certainly a cruel one, of avaricious global economic arrangements. And this is what Martin seeks to transform by inverting the logic of humanitarianism in unexpected ways. Amidst ethnic war and relentless economic exploitation, Martins explains, I initiated an emancipation program that aims to teach poor people how to benefit from their biggest resource, poverty. As a documentary set alongside a carefully scripted performance by Martins, Enjoy Poverty exposes the system of Congolese poverty, an exposure that is itself a significant act of a new politics of documentarism. Having learned that the AFP, a photographer, earns 50 euros per shot, Martins comes across a rundown photography stall called Bolingo, meaning love, as one of the employees explains. The business specializes in photos of birthday parties, ceremonies, and weddings, for which they charge 75 cents per photo, and advertises its model pictures taped to a makeshift cardboard display. Martins proposes the idea to them of providing aid to the Congolese poor, as represented by the workers at Bolingo, by teaching them Western-style photojournalism. For when Europeans come to the DRC, they don't come to film parties. They come to film misery and to lucrative ends, explains Martins. Should the Congolese follow suit, he explains, then they too might enjoy poverty, since there's clearly so much money in it. Cutting to an improvised classroom arranged in a thatch-roofed hut, the film shows a group of young men sitting before the artist, who proceeds to teach them a lesson in the economy of images. As he explains, if Congolese photographers wish to benefit financially from the practice of photography, then they should produce images of starvation, malnutrition, and violence, the country's natural resources, which are otherwise monopolized by European photojournalists who supply the global media that pay such high prices for these images. Here, Martins performs a mix of the colonial missionary and the motivational speaker, as he stands in front of a whiteboard on which he makes a handwritten graph and fills in numbers. He explains there are two options: war, raped women, corpses, and malnourished children, or birthdays and parties. He forms two columns on the board to display the costs, benefits, and profits of each. It turns out that the village photographers earn $1 per month by making pictures of parties, whereas photographing poverty and starvation with roughly 20 images per month at $50 a shot could bring in $1,000. The logic is worthy of Jonathan Swift, whose satirical 18th century A Modest Proposal suggested that the impoverished Irish sell their children as food to the wealthy. And Martins performs its crass immorality without any horror-diffusing wink or knowing nod. As it turns out, however, Martins' proposal is bound to fail. Global institutions refuse entry to the Congolese photographers, as is demonstrated in a scene where he brings his troop of photographers to the offices for Doctors Without Borders, who deride their ambitions as baldly opportunistic and talentless money-making enterprise, even as they acknowledge that New York Times photojournalists are in the same racket. Indeed, the Congolese cannot enjoy poverty in any other way, it seems, than to submit to its irrevocable reality of material destitution. That fatalism is itself transformed into a horrific scene showing Congolese poor plantation workers embracing their condition. After starting up a generator, Renzo Martins turns on a large bluish neon sign attached to a makeshift wooden armature, which reads, Enjoy Poverty. As the light shines forth, the crowd of children become rapturous, and drum music, singing, and dancing break out. And in a perverse moment of pop cultural arte povero performance, a young man plays an air guitar with a rough piece of wood. Martins ventriloquizes the idea, the ideal humanitarian, and his self-aggrandizing sentiment, drawing applause by saying, "Experiencing your suffering makes me a better person. You really help me. Thank you." Martin's project seems like it was designed for failure all along, and in fact, confronting that failure leads to the film's very lesson. When it comes to addressing the horrific living conditions, economic, flounderings, appalling hunger, and senseless violence in the Congo, art, according to Martens, cannot offer any answer, not even its critical, documentary, or socially engaged forms. Rather, the artistic system, of which Martin's own project is exemplary, is shown to be consistent with the very same global arrangements that structure the inequalities of humanitarianism in the media, such as exemplified in another of the film's parables, in which the artist visits a photography exhibition in Kinshasa that displays black and white images of toiling plantation workers. And Martin's interviews one visitor, himself a white plantation owner, who explains that he bought several of the images of sweating laborers dressed in rags, most likely shot on his own plantation, for their artistic value. More than a matter of local ethical scandal, the scene dramatizes a widespread paradox of contemporary art, particularly that of video and photography. It occurs when concerned documentary images intended to alleviate poverty or work for peace actually operate as commodity objects and are purchased by those who encourage or benefit from the very industries of inequality and exploitation against which the concerned documentarians justify their practice. Or to put it another way, the problem concerns mobilizing a politics of aesthetics, for example, imagery that reorganizes visibility so that those normally excluded from what counts now appear, in contexts such as commercial art galleries that perpetuate an exploitative distribution of the sensible, one of sheer consumerism and voyeuristic enjoyment. So I'm invoking Jacques Rancière's language here to point out a problem or limit within this theorization of the politics of aesthetics. The situation expresses a false proximity to the victimized that grants spectators distance from their complicity in the wider situation of generalized economic inequality. This problem, of course, is not new. In fact, it identifies art's difficult and long-standing location in a paradox endemic to liberalism, according to which art offers, on the one hand, a social-cultural progressivism supportive of human rights, individual freedoms, inequality, and principle, and concerned expressions of political sympathy with the oppressed, and on the other, the tacit acceptance, or at least the absence of a critique, of the wider economic system that perpetuates the very same social unfreedoms and global divisions against which that progressivism is posed. It's a paradox which has only grown more blatant in recent years. As the artist and theorist Hito Steirel has recently observed, the blind spot of contemporary political art dedicated to global crises is to overlook the often compromised local conditions of its production and display, a situation reeking of the exploitation of armies of interns and financially driven by politically unsavory benefactors such as multinational banks and arms dealers. In her view, quote, "We could try to understand art's space as a political one instead of trying to represent a politics that is always happening elsewhere." She's surely right to point out this negligence, but it is, in my view, a false choice. We can and must work on multiple fronts, not one or the other. This is, I think, the significance of Martin's work, to critically locate political images in networks of consumption and distribution that support forms of inequality, and putting himself in the midst of those networks and its contradictions and failures, or rather his self-constructed avatar of the do-gooder artist, as he walks around for much of the film, of the time in the film, with a camera trained on his own face in an insistent act of self-reflexive exposure and criticality. At the same time, it's important to resist the potential reductiveness of such critiques that politically conservative contexts, funding bodies, and commercial institutions somehow completely determine, as if by necessity, the meaning of art, or that politically engaged work cannot operate in unanticipated or strategic ways against the very contexts that frame it. It's this structure of negation that Enjoy Poverty breaks down, doing so by placing documentary imagery and critiques of poverty in relation to systems of production and reception that produce inequality. Martens, first of all, shows how empathy is connected to the market, leading to perhaps the most difficult aspect of the film, the representation of the black body, and particularly the child's body, which is most vulnerable. In one galling scene, the film shows sick and starving children in an ill-equipped medical clinic, It's at this point that we confront some of the most difficult questions regarding Martin's strategy. How can such depictions be justified, no matter what Martin's deconstructive intentions? Is this a case where even the last remaining dignity of an impoverished and dying human being is taken away by a debasing artistic portrayal? How can one validate or explain the exposure of a horror whose reality is a catastrophic failure on ethical, political, and humanitarian grounds? And is this exposure of bare life, stripped of political rights and humanitarian protections and reduced to mere biological existence, also an unacceptable reproduction of bare life, no matter what one's critical motivations? When I posed these questions to Renzo Martins, he responded, quote, "The conditions of these children are actually justified all the time. It's called the market. Whatever the reasons, we thrive on it. I think it's unfair for audiences to want to have it both ways, cheap labor on the one hand, and yet on the other, being exempted from any confrontation with the results, malnourished and dying children, their parents feeling entirely helpless, on the grounds that representation of such lives would be immoral. Morality then serves profitability," he says. And Joy Poverty shows these brutal facts, and these scenes are among the most disturbing in the film. They haunt precisely because we as viewers can do nothing about the tragedies. We can confront only the impotency of the empathic response. They haunt because of the insignificance of artistic critique when compared to the monumentality of human suffering. But it's not that these images should be stoically embraced by documentary realists. Rather, we need to critically address the larger economic and political causes of such suffering and thereby exercise the ineffective strategies and break the spell of the haunting. In this regard, Martin's film shows and importantly problematizes social documentary's conventional production of empathy with its represented victims, which nonetheless continues to gain purchase among various practitioners and critics today. For instance, Susie Linfield has recently argued that without empathy, the politics of human rights would devolve into abstraction, romantic foolishness, and cruelty. And she finds the ability to foster empathy to be one of photography's greatest powers. And I noticed that Sharon Slawinski recently spoke here as well, and she's, I think, also proposes, you know, discusses in a quite complicated way the politics of empathy. At the same time, Susie Linfield's neo-humanist argument offers no explanation for what the exact efficacy of empathy is and fails to acknowledge the global image economy in which such imagery circulates and where morality indeed serves profitability. And Joy Poverty clearly departs from this strategy in this sense rather takes seriously the warning of someone like Susan Sontag, who writes about how empathy can be an inappropriate response as it produces a guilt-effacing mystification of the fact that the wealth of some may imply the destitution of others. Martin's film hardly sets aside painful images. Rather, it offers a massive dose of them, but does so in order to place our privileges on the same map as the suffering of others. The artist, playing up the cruelty of his character until the very end, tells the father of the girl whose sick body was presented to the camera earlier in the film that he should expect no benefit from this film project. And he goes on to explain to the man that if he has been working on a plantation for 10 years and still doesn't have a TV or a radio, a bicycle, suit, or leather shoes, then he probably won't be able to afford such things anytime soon. For Martins, this exercise is intended to show how making this film, quote, is in itself a process analogous to making chocolate, coffee, coltan, or gold. The power equation between those who consume and those who supply the raw materials in those industries is the same, regardless of what specific product is produced. In other words, art is no exception to these economies and offers no redemption to the world of inequality, exploitation, and cruelty, a point Martins frequently makes. In this regard, Martins embraces his film's own inconsequentiality. Acknowledging the failure of art's critical ambitions, documenting poverty for the sake of empathy, leads, however, to an uncertain politicization. Yet that may also be the point. Martin's film doesn't identify what strategy one should follow in the wake of its deconstruction of a certain brand of political art. it leaves a vacuum in which we as viewers must determine the next step. As such, Martin's work makes a contribution, I think, to a new kind of institutional critique. And here I'm thinking of recent essays like one by Andrea Fraser, that was published in Texte zur Kunst called L'une personne, c'est moi, which is, I think, a really important recent contribution to the discourse. And that contribution is that it breaks out of the Western parochialism of such practice, obsessed as it often is with the ideological functions of museums and galleries in the West, and investigates the image economy of humanitarianism set in the expanded field of neoliberal globalization, and critically analyzes the production of Congolese poverty in relation to macroeconomic institutions like the World Bank and media enterprises like Agence France-Presse. And most importantly, Enjoy Poverty situates itself in these very conditions. After viewing Martin's work, it becomes impossible to look at other documentary accounts in the same way. That is, without considering their embeddedness in the market and in the market's economy of images. As Judith Butler argues, if there is a critical role for visual culture during times of war, it is precisely to thematize the forcible frame, the one that conducts the dehumanizing norm, that restricts what is perceivable and indeed what can be. Such is a good approximation of what Martin's has done, breaking through the typical layers of negation and structures of invisibility to lay bare to lay bare the forcible frame of the image in which poverty is produced and consumed. He does so particularly where empathy figures as a dubious engine of political transformation, and more often than not, an excuse for inaction. If Enjoy Poverty invites, without predetermining, a response, then it is one, in my view, that would reject the conditions witnessed in the film, abandon the pornography of poverty, and assess the unjust structures of globalization that are poverty's conditions of possibility. It would also entail the promotion of artistic and activist practices that facilitate positive social transformation in zones of conflict, rather than remaining enthralled and immobilized by poverty's spectacularized and commodified representations. Thanks very much.
Hello, I think you mentioned that companies and the United Nations, the UN refugee organization, the UNHCR, I think it is, put their logo on things. I think it's to deter theft and resale and for people stealing the stuff and just reselling it. It's harder to resell with the UN logo. Maybe they cover it up. I've never been to Africa. I've never been to a relief situation, but that's what I've read.
Thanks. In the film, there's an encounter between the artist and the representative, and she explains that the reason they put logos on things is for visibility. So I'm sure it's for multiple reasons, including the ones that you mentioned. But I'm going with how the film presents it.
I'm reminded of an ancient Chinese art form that places a box within a box within a box within a box ad infinitum. Now, undoubtedly, the efforts of many so-called liberalized groups ends up commodifying and objectifying the very poverty that they're helping to reduce. But then the critics of these people are playing the same role. They're making an industry, academic or otherwise, of criticizing the so-called do-gooders. And then others come along and criticize them, and the chain keeps on repeating itself. In the meantime, and based on the questionable assumption that you made towards the end of the paper, that if we removed the sort of false leads, the red herrings, we might really get to address the real structural problems that are creating the mess in the first place. Unfortunately, there's no evidence of this. And unfortunately, we haven't really come up with any usable methods to change the indifference that is practiced by most people, including most of us in this very room, who are doing very little, not only about Africa or other places, but even Montreal's homeless. So it seems to me that it's a paradox that you're just endlessly repeating over and over again without really, I mean, much as is justified, without really coming up with any viable alternative.
Thanks for that question. I don't think it's an endless reproduction of a paradox, a box within a box ad infinitum. I think that this film, I would argue, is different from others, and it allows us to have discussions like this and arguments that bring up these larger conditions that deal with the what some would call the colonial present in relationship to the IMF and World Bank. I don't know of hardly any other artwork that deals with those kind of questions on that scale. And the condition in the Congo is really significant, particularly in relationship to the past relationship to Belgium and Europe as well. So again, I think it's the critique of the image economy that is articulated in the film is not just another iteration of the same old thing. I think it's a quite a significant and powerful film. And people are proposing solutions. There are a variety of different alternatives and solutions that people are proposing. And I bring that out in the larger essay in my book. One proposal that I think is really interesting is by a Malian filmmaker named Abderrahman Sissako. He did this film called Bamako, which is quite interesting. It proposes a community-based theater project to place the IMF and World Bank on trial, and it motivated a lot of community activism. I think that's crucial, and it's important to point to things like that as positive expressions of affirmative activism that are actually doing something. It's not succeeding in putting an end to the IMF and the World Bank, but it is something that we can do, and I think we, those of us who are concerned, would be supportive of such gestures.
How do they evaluate the work of non-governmental organizations? And he suggested that for the individuals or small groups concerned in both the giving and taking, it can be a life-affirming experience. However, on a global level, he felt it was dysfunctional because it created the illusion of progress that was only really minimal, and it relieved the pressure necessary to make the major structural changes. So we're stuck with the same dilemma over and over again. We're damned if we do and damned if we don't. And nobody has come up with a way yet of squaring the circle.
I would point to, there's a really great book called Economic Alternatives to Globalization, and it's written by a group of people called the International Forum on Globalization, and they're mobilizing for the dismantling of the World Bank and the IMF. That's what I would point to as a solution. That's what I would support politically as well. I mean, this book is, I think, really useful and interesting on that level. So I don't think it's endlessly squaring the circle or endless paradox.
I'm a bit skeptical about the artist's project of getting the poor people to take photographs. So he was like enticing them to take photographs and saying that they could potentially get 50 euros per photograph. And then in the end, of course, the Western agency weren't going to buy those photos. And I'm a bit skeptical of that because he could have assumed that they weren't going to be bought or sold. That was not surprising. So in a sense, he is using and abusing these people who themselves probably thought they might eventually make money. So I don't think that's all that ethical. I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about that, or how he may have justified that.
But that was my point. It's a performance, and he's performing that role, and he's performing it cruelly, and he's performing it in order to bring out a response like the one that you're having, to make the viewer uncomfortable, to make the viewer complicit in a way in the enjoyment of poverty, also from their point of view. So it's meant to bring about certain effects, and I'm trying to analyze those effects that I think can be productive as well.
But I mean, you're talking about an effect with me as an audience, right?
Sorry?
But I mean, you're talking right now the exchange between, for example, me as the audience.
And
but
me
I'm
as
talking,
well. And me as
no,
well.
But I mean, what about the poor people who are wasting their time taking the pictures? Like, what
the
about
Congolese
that?
Photographers?
Pardon?
The Congolese photographers.
Yes.
Well, they go away in the film, and they're disheartened and upset that they weren't able to do anything, and they return to their, you know,
right.
to their life.
But
so
I
it's
mean,
a
he
it's
could
depicted
have,
it's yeah. depicted as a failure, right? It's depicted as a failure. In other words, these mechanisms that we are familiar with ultimately fail, and Renzo Martin's project, his modest proposal, also fails. But
well.
But Swift didn't exploit actual people in making a modest proposal. I think
yeah.
that's the ethical problem that this person is pointing to.
Okay.
That it's one thing to perform something in order to enlighten the audience, but it's another thing to do that by using people in
right.
this way. And that, I think, is the ethical crux of the ethical problem.
Yeah, it's again. It's it, but it's there, that presumes that Renzo. I don't know if this is part of the problem or the issue here, but it presumes there's one response that presumes that Renzo Martin's in the film is Renzo Martin's a person, and in fact he's a character, and it's a performance. It's in some ways a theatrical situation that he's set up. Now what you see in the film and its narrative of failure. Is not necessarily what happens in reality in terms of his relationship to those people. And that's another part of the complicated story. I mean, he has contracts with them. He attempts to help them out in terms of their photographic practice, but it's not part of the film.
Are they aware of it as a performance? Have they agreed to be performers?
Yeah, because they know.
They've agreed to.
Yeah,
I'm asking if they are aware that it's a performance
yes.
and have agreed to perform in this, knowing that it's going to be a failure.
Yes. In fact, they've signed contracts with him so that they get a portion of the profits of the film. So there's a whole there's another layer outside of the film and the construction that it is. That is not represented in the film or not pointed to, and that's part of, that adds to the. To the partly, you know, constructed element of what happens in the film.
So it's acted out.
Yeah. It's not acted. It's not exactly acted, but it's...
Well, they've agreed to be the... Victim.
Well, they've agreed to do the... To, you know, to go along with what he's proposing. And
they agreed to do it in order to demonstrate the failure.
I don't know how much they like what kind of negotiations he had with them. I'm just trying to point out that it's not we can't just assume that this is a documentary that shows a truthful social, economic, political relationship between Renzo Martins and these people. You know, Martha.
This is so it's an inversion of the Nanook bargain, where the Nanook people. Collaborated with Flaherty in order to show the basic heroism of everyday life in the Arctic. So this is, you know, we've turned the corner where people supposedly are agreeing to represent the victims for a share in the profits. But I have another question. I'm going to read something. I hope it's okay. Since I'm sitting here with my computer, I realized I could call up my email. So bear with me. I hope you're well. Renato Wagner of the Berlin Biennial and myself have written you before on the opening seminar of the Institute for Human Activities in the Congo. It takes place June 11th and 12th on a specially created settlement in the Congolese rainforest, 800 kilometers upscale from Kinshasa, and is the opening event of a capital G gentrification, capital P program, gentrification program. In the transfer, and I'm skipping a paragraph, in the transfer of critical art from a zone of intervention to the zone of reception, a gap seems to arise. This gap seems very similar to the division between labor and profit in other globalized industries. Art may expose the need for change in Iraq, Nigeria, Peru, but in the end it brings opportunity, beauty, and real estate value to Berlin Mitte or Chelsea in the Lower East Side in New York. In an attempt of a more insightful response, we build up a 5-year gentrification program. We try to recalibrate art terms and conditions, including one of its most speculated upon side effects, the accumulation of privilege, capital, and prestige in its zones of reception. What is at stake is art's mandate in this world. And since this is the home, though not the city, of Richard Florida, I think people will recognize the culture class. That this is my aside, the culture class idea. I continue. This settlement is located in close proximity of the plantation that was owned by Unilever up to a few years ago and from where in the century, for the century, palm oil was produced, etc. Unilever nurtured a humanitarian image in the West, but its legacy is gruesome and forced labor was common until recently. Well, I declined to go, but did you go?
Yeah, I went to the opening seminar.
Tell us about the seminar on gentrification in Kinshasa.
Well, Christina, do we have...
You have a few minutes.
Okay. Just very quickly, but that was... this is his current project. It's a 5-year project, and that was the inaugural seminar. It was a 2-day event outside of Kinshasa, and there were 2 days dedicated to make an intervention in this area, in the local economy. It's largely plantations, as you mentioned, historically run by companies like Unilever during colonial times. And it was, for me, a difficult decision, should I go to this or not, knowing the difficulty of Renzo's practices and the trickiness about how people are represented in them. But I had many discussions with him about this and felt like I could ultimately go and be a participant without necessarily endorsing the project. So I have that kind of relationship to it, a guarded one, and let's see what happens with it. In my presentation, I did everything possible to try to bring up the problems, the obvious problems with using gentrification as a term, my skepticism about redeploying gentrification in a different or critical way, the fact that Richard Florida was also beamed in via Skype. I'm obviously opposed to all this, but I thought I could go and participate and see what this is. And I think it was really, for me, what was very interesting was the first, there were 2 days, and the first day was all Congolese participants, professors and activists, and some very interesting people were taking part in this discussion of this location, its history, its relationship to multinational globalization today. So it was a very interesting experience for me.
Thank you.